Morning, officers. What y'all, the second team?
We're the first team.
Yeah, we're not gonna fall for a banana in the tailpipe.
You're not gonna fall for the banana in the tailpipe?
It should be more natural, brother. It should flow out like this.
Look, man, I ain't falling for no banana in my tailpipe.
You're listening to The Hollywood Saloon.
How you doing?
Send Gigli over.
It's Gigli, by the way.
What?
My name is pronounced Gigli. It rhymes with really.
In every relationship, there's a bull and a cow. It just so happens that in this relationship right here with me and you, I'm the bull. You're the cow. All right? Bull. Cow.
It's turkey time.
Huh?
Gobble, gobble.
Walking through a party in the county jail.
Hollywood hates failure. They think the stench is catching and no one likes to smell bad in Los Angeles. If you've directed a movie and it fails spectacularly, you can be sent to a place designed specifically so that no one in the business catches even the faintest whiff of your cinematic stink. It's called Movie Jail, and it's an ugly, ugly place.
We go to jail, pal. They're gonna put me in jail.
What? Jail?
And that's what we're talking about here on the Hollywood Saloon today. We are at episode 13.
And
1-3, the lucky number 13, and this is Lockdown Movie Jail. And I am Andy, and with me, of course, is Human Film Database, John Jansen.
Hello, and welcome to the saloon.
Welcome. Absolutely. And so we're talking today about this mythical, magical place that exists out there in Hollywood. And it goes by different names. Movie jail, director jail, whatever you want to call it. That opening that I read actually came from director Richard Shepard, who's got The Matador coming out pretty soon, about his experiences in movie jail. It's a great article, and we'll have a link to that over on the Hollywood Saloon site. We'll talk about that later. But, you know...
I wanted to say one thing about it. It's quite revealing because, again, he's not a name that immediately leaps to mind. You know, he's one of those few hundred, you know, people out there that are just working, but we don't necessarily know their name, you know,
right,
behind the work.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty of people. There's people you've definitely heard of, guys who've got a huge, great track record, who've made huge hits, hit machines, you know, and then they make one bad movie and they're off the chart. You don't hear from them for a few years. And so, you know, like I said, that's what we're looking at today. Obviously, at the very beginning of the show, we played a little clips from a good old movie you might have heard of called Gigli.
Giggly?
Giggly.
It's Gigli, by the way.
And, you know, that was from our buddy Martin Brest. And,
or would you prefer it be called Tough Love?
Oh, was that what it was originally called?
They were trying every title with that thing.
And he was so tough, let me tell you.
Well, he thought it was funny.
Martin Brest?
Martin Brest obviously thought it was funny.
He thought the name Gigli was funny.
He came up with it.
Right, right.
Who comes up with Gigli?
It's Gigli, by the way.
And I think the craziest thing is that obviously he is in... I mean, you would have to think that after a film like Gigli bombed so spectacularly, financially and openly in the public in Hollywood, that would definitely put someone into some kind of a phantom zone in Hollywood, you know, some place that you're not going to come back from for a while.
And well, if he had a project set up that was pricey, you can guarantee his phone calls weren't returned after the opening of Gigli.
Right.
I mean, that can even happen to the top name directors in town. And, you know, it's fair to note, Martin Brest is a top name in Hollywood. I mean, he's an A-list director. Not made a lot of films, per se, but, I mean, when you look across his career, not a lot of people remember his first film, Going in Style. George Burns, Art Carney, and Lee Strasberg. But it's a very engaging caper movie, you know, with some, senior citizens in it. But it has a warm heart to it, and it shows a type of grittiness and also a reality that's in his work as a director. And the film will surprise you. It's a nice little gem to discover. And his second film went through the roof, Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's one of the highest grossing films and one of the highest grossing comedies of all time. But it's also, you know, a beloved film, and it was the breakout vehicle for Eddie Murphy. Although, you know, 48 Hours,
right,
you could argue. But this is the film that cemented him as a single leading man star. It was huge in 84.
And pretty much after Bress did that, he could do anything he wanted to do.
Anything he wanted. And he took his time, because his next film would not be until summer 87,
mm-hmm,
with Midnight Run.
Jack, you're a grown man. You have control over your own words.
You're goddamn right I do. So here come two words for you. Shut the fuck up.
And what a follow-up, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you could argue that it's a better film, you know, in script.
I would say better film altogether.
Execution, absolutely, in Beverly Hills Cop is.
Yeah.
But De Niro giving one of his funniest performances on film.
In Grodin.
I know he's going back into comedy of late, but him and Grodin, the most unlikely team, but they're wonderful together.
Right, absolutely. Well, it had a lot of sharpness to it, too. I mean, it wasn't just a comedy. There was, it had an edge to it, too. Yeah, pretty tense stuff. But, yeah, I mean, this is an example. A guy who's got this kind of movies. And then he even went on to do Scent of a Woman, which was a big hit, too.
It was.
Which
was
brought Pacino his Oscar.
If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place.
You know, also introduced some fresh faces in it, like Philip Seymour Hoffman,
right,
and Chris O'Donnell.
Right.
But, you know, and I think that was the film where they started to, you know, the big argument of it was, it's 2 hours and, 20 minutes long, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, well, I mean, actually not really, you know, but 3 hours would be a long movie. But that was considered a long movie.
Right.
And then he would go even a step further by making a 3-hour Meet Joe Black.
Hello, I'm Joe Black. It's nice meeting you.
Right.
That just a lot of people did not like or appreciate that film at all.
Right.
When I first saw it, and I've only seen it once, to be fair, but I found it kind of refreshing because the rhythms were so different. The movie was in no hurry. It reminded me of a lot like how when you see live theater. You know, nothing was necessarily rushed in there. You know, time slowed down to where you could actually observe. And, I was engaged by the film. It's got some wonderful moments.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, definitely. I've seen it once, but I definitely remember liking it. But
his clout of Final Cut is the reason why that movie is 3 hours long. And this is exactly what is going to trap him in his next film, Geely, because he does have Final Cut power. And from what I understand, I mean, Revolution, Joe Rolfe's company who financed the movie, I think they even knew it was in trouble, and they tried a lot of alternate things, reshot the ending, recut the movie, and it never really tested any better than Martin Brest's version was testing, and it wasn't testing very well.
Well, and I think this movie, Martin Brest is 100% responsible for this because, you know, he's the writer, he's the producer, and he's the director. I mean, this is his kid. And mm-hmm. But I think, you know, ahead of time, you have a lot of baggage coming in this movie when you cast, a real-life Hollywood couple like Affleck and Lopez. And at that point in time, you know, they were at the top of their game. I mean, you know, Lopez had her CDs out, and or J-Lo, I should say.
And her clothing line.
Her clothing line and everything. And it was almost like overkill. You know, it's like no one wanted to see the chick anymore. You know, it's like, please stop. Just disappear for a couple years. And then Affleck, and then and it's a very ridiculous movie as far as their characters go. I mean, she's fine, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, just I'm not even going to comment on the movie because I wasn't even going to see it. But you said, no, you need to see it if we're going to talk about it. So I went and saw it, and it was pretty awful, you know.
For the rest of your life now, you can talk about Geely.
It's Geely, by the way.
Yeah.
And you know what you saw. There's so many people out there that tell me how bad Geely is, but they've never seen it.
Jiggly.
It's Geely, by the way.
And, you know, okay. I mean,
right.
I'm going to disagree with you only because you haven't seen it. You don't know how bad it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's better than you think it is in some ways.
I mean,
because it's not the worst movie ever made.
No, it's not the worst movie ever made.
It's not a schlocky, you know,
no.
Sort of C picture. But it's an ambitious failure, but it's really not all that ambitious to begin with. you know. I mean, it's a very simple little story, and it's trying to combine a couple of different genres.
Well, it,
you know,
has
the comedy gangster and the Rain Man genre, right?
Very much Rain Man with the kid who looked like a Screech from Saved by the Bell.
I have to go with the Baywatch.
And they tried to, you know, make some, you know, some playing your heartstrings there and all that kind of stuff. But it was very much, you know, I was like, man, this is Rain Man. Give me a break here.
I have to go with the Baywatch. I was going to go.
You know, and, you know, wasn't he tied to Rain Man in the past? Am I right? Somewhere way back in Rain Man's history?
I don't know. I know Spielberg was involved before Barry Levinson was.
I may be wrong, but it doesn't matter. But anyways, yeah, I mean, just as a movie together, it wasn't as bad as you think. I had a couple laughs in it, but really it's just Affleck and J-Lo in a room together carrying this movie for 3 hours. You know
it's
what
like
I mean?
It's like flat soda, you know.
It really is. And
it's wet and it's liquid. You know, there's flavoring in it, but it's just hard to taste it anymore.
But anyways, it doesn't matter because I think we're both in agreement that it's a pretty, you know, lame movie altogether. And it hurts because we know that Martin Brest is better than that. But anyways, it is what it is, you know, and I have not very much love lost for Ben Affleck, not a big fan of his. But anyways,
I think it's fair to say this comment, and I think it'll be echoed throughout the episode with several directors. Is often it takes a talented director to make a movie that bad.
Yeah.
And if that sounds like an oxymoron, think about it a little bit more, because sometimes the most talented directors can get lost or out of tune and stay out of tune and not even realize it.
Right.
You know, like a musician can be out of tune sometimes and maybe they can't hear their playback or something and they just keep playing and everyone else notices, but they don't. You know, I mean, I think of someone like Brian De Palma in Bonfire of the Vanities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's an ambitious failure.
Right.
You know, and instead of, you know, sit around in director's jail to wait for another big Hollywood movie, De Palma went back and wrote and directed Raising Cain. Did a small little thriller that, you know, he was sort of made his name for in the 70s and 80s, and then came back with Carlito's Way after that, you know.
Which was a fairly big hit, if I'm...
Yeah, and
right,
a return to style and form from De Palma, and then he had his biggest hit with Mission Impossible.
Right.
So, you know, he kind of was able to sweep, you know, the Bonfire, you know.
Well, if your name is is Brian De Palma, I think you're able to break out of any kind of movie jail a little bit just because your name is already out there and recognized as kind of a standard bearer for a while, since he was especially hooked in with Coppola and all those and that whole Zoetrope group.
And he's a master filmmaker. I mean, you know, it just wasn't the best marriage of material and director.
Right.
But
right.
Give him another piece of material and he's going to do fine.
Right.
You know,
right.
He'll even do a little bit above the Call of Duty. And I look forward to his new film based on the James Ellroy novel, The Black Dahlia.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like a perfect marriage between what De Palma can bring and, you know, story, and he just, you know, he can make great movies.
Sure. Well, anyways, I mean, like I said, we're looking at guys like Martin Brest, Brian De Palma. You know, these guys they've got the chops. We know that. But still, you know, there is this place called movie director jail. I mean, what is movie director jail? I mean, it's an unspoken thing. It's obviously on the mouths of people in Hollywood. Movie jail. I mean, I guess actors can go to movie jail too. But, I mean, it's not a real place. It doesn't really exist. And you don't hear people talking about it. It's not like they'll call up and, you know, and say, well, no, he's in director jail. We can't can't have him. But I think it's just an understood thing that if your movie came out and it was a bomb, there's kind of a, I don't know what, like a stench to it or something.
Well, it's the same way. If your movie opens up on Friday and it's the number one movie of the week, your phone will ring on Monday. It will ring from everybody in town because they want to be a part of that success. They think you know some formula now, you know, and they're going to hire you for their big movie. And then that big movie is going to come out and it's going to flop. It's going to tank. And that director's phone will not ring on Monday, you know?
Right.
And it's cycles, and you know it works in waves like that. I think it's important to preface here: we are talking about very lucky individuals,
absolutely,
because A, they got to direct
right.
a feature film,
mm-hmm.
And they left about 2,000 other wannabe directors in Los Angeles behind when they got the job to actually do it,
right,
you know?
Right.
And again, there's a seat of responsibility you have to take on there. You know, you are expected to deliver, and there's nothing worse than you can do than deliver a failure.
Well, and you know, Richard Shepard talked about in that article that's in Filmmaker Magazine, you know, he had said that, you know, and this was back when he did the David Bowie flick, the Linguini Incident.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what year it was, but
it seems like around 91-ish, 91, 92.
Okay. So, yeah, and he was talking about, you know, I got to go to the Hollywood parties, and everyone was calling me a genius, and I was all this, and I was the shit, you know, and yada yada. And then when the movie came out and tanked like it did and got the bad response, it was like death. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Just totally left out in the cold. And, I mean, it's the same story over and over. And it's kind of like, you know, I mean, I'm guessing it's just this little stink that a movie has on it. Because think about it. If you're putting your money on the line here and your ass on the line, and the director that's supposed to do your project or the director you're talking to is the guy who just put out Gigli, I don't think so. I don't think your investors are going to be interested in that. And I think you're going to be a little scared that this person, you know, just put out. It's like, oh, is this something that's going to continue? Is he going to do this again? You know, especially mm-hmm. if he's the kind of director that has final credit. And I'd be very interested to see, you know, when Martin Brest directs again, if he gets that final credit. I mean, that final cut.
Sure.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's just that stink that it has after it. You know, I mean, look at Gigli. I mean, they spent $54 million on it and it made $6 million.
Right.
I mean, it's a complete, you know, massacre at the box office. And, you know, maybe it went on to make some movie and some money on video and whatnot.
Plus also the critical response and the audience response. I mean, it failed in all three quadrants. Because sometimes you can have a movie that doesn't make a lot of box office, doesn't necessarily get a lot of great critical reviews, but becomes a huge audience favorite and a hit and a cult movie.
Right.
Office Space springs to mind.
I believe you have my stapler.
Nobody was really talking about that movie all that much until people got a chance to see it.
Yeah.
Movies can have a life like that, but if you fail in all three quadrants, you're in trouble. You're taking up space on a shelf.
Right.
Because you become then a curiosity item. You know, if you're so bad, you know, then people want to check it out. I mean, last year when the whole, or it was actually in 2003 when the whole film festival, Vincent Gallo, The Brown Bunny, Roger Ebert incident started, you know, flaring up and calling it, you know, the worst film in Cannes history and everything like that. You know, it would be a year later before, you know, audiences even got a chance to see The Brown Bunny, and it had built up such a reputation, you know, right, that it couldn't possibly live up to being the worst film of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Much like films can't live up to being the best film of all time, you know?
Sure.
But I don't know if Vincent Gallo's in director's jail, because that was his movie. He wrote it, he directed it, he edited it, he produced it, he photographed it, he acted in it.
Well, and it's with anybody.
And he's proud of it. It was the movie he wanted to make.
Well, and it's anyone who's an indie, you know, he's got his opportunity to do it again. I mean, I guess director jail doesn't really keep you from directing, because, I mean, it keeps you from directing Hollywood studio-driven blockbusters, you know what
right.
I mean?
It keeps you out of the club, and that's yeah. almost a way to look at it, is there is a certain kind of, you know, elite club that, you know, they're real quick to invite you in, but, you know, fail to deliver, and you're gone, you know?
Well, and a lot of these guys who get kicked out and put in director jail or movie jail end up directing television, and, you know, as we've said before, that's not such a bad place to be these days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you do a couple of TV movies, and maybe you're back in the saddle. I mean, you know, and someone's willing to give you a chance.
It's interesting to me, though, that perspective by directing a couple of TV movies would suddenly make you a hot property to be a feature film director again.
Right.
That's odd to me that there is that perception in town. But it must be that, you know, that you can just go through, humbly take on a project and, you know, bring it to completion without any issues and, you know, turn in a product that's good. To me, it seems like, though, a director coming off a failure is the best time to hire him.
Because he's hungry and he wants to prove himself.
They need to get into another project and just divert all their focus and all their energy right into something else and pull out, you know, the great work. I mean, what did Spielberg do right after 1941? He jumped right into Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You know?
Didn't bat an eye and just moved on to the next film.
Right.
You know? I'm not saying that, you know, 1941 was a colossal flop or anything like that, but it was perceived as such in that time.
Right.
Just because when you have two big blockbusters in a row, they're going to be coming at you with everything for your next movie. You know, much in the same way I think you've seen with M. Night Shyamalan. And, you know, they're just, they've been coming out, you know, ready to knock him down a peg or two also in The Village.
Sure,
you know.
Sure.
But he fought back, or he won, I mean, because The Village opened huge.
Right.
It still did $100 million, right. You know. A film like that should never have done that much, but it did that much because of him.
No, I liked it, so.
He's a brand name into it itself, you know.
Oh, yeah. But when you get your name over the credits, I mean, oh, you know, when it becomes M. Night Blita, when it comes to, you know, like John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're in there. I mean, that doesn't happen very often.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, there's also, I mean, so the different levels of movie jail, I think that's important to look at. There is the industry perceived movie jail, to where there's not necessarily a list, but word is out.
Right.
And no one is calling you, and no one is really interested in working with you or hiring you.
Right.
Because of that flop. And you almost need to wait a couple of years until the memory of it has faded a little bit, and you can kind of work your way back into favor.
Right.
Now, maybe you go off and you go do commercials or music videos, and then you come back and, you know, you find the right, you know, marriage of script and talent. I mean,
right.
Obviously, Hollywood is always in need of hiring people, but there's a lot more people to hire than they're ever going to. You know, there's a giant talent pool of directors out there, but right. a lot of the same ones are working.
Well, and you know, I've noticed that you know, there is kind of a forgiving period. You know what I mean? When I've looked at some of the distances between the flop that someone directed and then their next film, is it traditionally seems to be like somewhere between 6 and 10 years, where it's a clean slate. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. like okay, well, yeah, we know you did so and so back then, and it tanked. You know, but. We know that you also before that did some movies that were pretty damn good. So mm-hmm. we, you know, we're willing to take that shot again, and they're probably willing to take that shot with that person above going and getting someone brand new who's untested.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, look at Phil Juanu.
Good example.
You know what I mean? Someone who we really loved back in the 80s. You know, he started with those amazing stories. He was real hooked up with Spielberg in there right out of USC. You know, did 3 o'clock High in 87, and you know we love that movie.
Interesting to note, Spielberg took his name off 3 o'clock High at the time.
Oh, really?
I think it was because it was rated R.
Hmm.
And he wasn't putting his name on rated R movies at the time.
Especially one that was a high school movie.
Yeah. But he also took his name off Fandango, strangely enough, too.
Oh, gosh.
Although he did produce both.
I love Fandango.
Was associated with both movies.
Right.
But, yeah, love 3 O'Clock High. You know, I think his work on Rattlin' Hum
mm-hmm.
is stellar. And I think today it's even better than most of the work I see of live concerts on how they're filmed today.
Yeah.
At least he can hold a shot for 4 seconds, mm-hmm. you know, keep
well,
it interesting.
Absolutely. And I mean, and he's proved himself there. And then he even did it a notch higher when he did State of Grace in 1990 with Sean Penn. You know,
right.
I mean, man.
You know?
Still, I will say to this day that end gun battle is probably one of my favorites in movies, period. You know what I mean? Just good old Peckinpah, slow motion, blood pack spewing, mm-hmm. you know, fantastic scene. I definitely own that one.
He's also working with, you know, two of the cinema's best. I mean, Sean Penn and Gary Oldman.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, that's a stellar cast. And,
absolutely.
You know, he was right at home in the material. I think his direction on the film is very good. It's very character-orientated because there's not a lot of action in the film at
mm-hmm,
all
mm-hmm.
except for the ending, and that's appropriate. It's fine.
Right.
Because when it comes, it's an explosion. But,
oh, and it's an explosion, and the cross-cutting is powerful with the parade and everything. So,
see, unfortunately, that film, though, came out right around the same time as Goodfellas.
Right.
Which was about a month after Miller's Crossing. You know, there was
these movies, and it kind of got lost in the shuffle.
And then, of course, Godfather 3 opened at Christmas.
Right.
You know? So within a 3-month period, all four of those movies came out.
Mm-hmm.
And State of Grace was the one that did get lost, sort of, in mm-hmm. that shuffle.
I would definitely want to tell our listeners to rent State of Grace,
directed by Phil Jona, great little gem that kind of got lost in there. But then after that, he went on to...
Well, he took the commercial picture after that, and it might have been because State of Grace wasn't a big hit. And I'm sure he was being pressured to deliver a Basic Instinct or something. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to deliver a hit.
Right.
And he tried with Final Analysis. Gere, Kim Basinger, Uma Thurman psychological thriller.
Right.
And while I think his style in the picture, it's a San Francisco picture, I believe, and, you know, there's, he even had Jordan Cronenweth shoot the film for him. The film looks great. I think his handling of the actors is good. But he, and I don't have all the facts of the story, but apparently Phil and Richard Gere butted heads throughout the production.
Uh-huh.
And it came down to serious blows. And Phil got a tainted reputation all over town after that movie.
Well, and it was
almost a form of director's jail by the bad-mouthing that was going on about him. And, you know, I think if you ever see a film he did called Entropy.
Right, 99.
And I know you've seen it. But I think he exercised a lot of those demons of being the hot young wonder kid coming into Hollywood with full of all these expectations, you know, making some films of promise and then coming out. And the worst of all is, you know, Final Analysis did not make money.
Right.
It flopped, which was the worst sin of all, you know.
Right.
After all that, it still wasn't a big hit. I don't know if it flopped, if that's fair to say, but it wasn't a huge hit.
Yeah,
it didn't do 100.
I don't have numbers on it, but, you know, I know that he did that, and that was the movie that really tainted him, was that that was the one that said, you know, that after that we're saying, okay, director jail. I know that he batted around some TV episodes, Third Rock from the Sun. We know that he did some more YouTube videos with his buddies.
He directed a Wild Palms, that miniseries that Oliver Stone produced.
Right.
Yeah.
So he was working in TV a little bit. In 96, he did a movie that no one saw called Heaven's Prisoners.
Right, Alec Baldwin.
Which kind of just came and went. And then he did his little personal deal in Entropy, which came and went. And here's the interesting thing is that after 99, there's a couple of little TV deals here and there. Some U2, some more U2, you know, like compilation video stuff. But really, he hasn't worked since about 99 in films. And here's the interesting thing is I'm guessing Hollywood's forgetting, you know, what happened with Phil. But now when I look at Internet Movie Database, it says he's got three movies, you know, that he's hooked up to do.
Yeah.
Gridiron Gang, A Walk Amongst the Tombstones, and Hammer Down. Three movies set for next year. So, you know, who knows if all three of them will get set up to go. But, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if he gets one of them. And it's interesting because I guess – Is that what we see, the forgiving period here? It's like, okay, you've sat in director jail long enough. We know you're very capable. I mean, all you got to do is look back to his earlier films in the 80s and early 90s, and you know that the man can make a film.
I mean, I guess, you know, they come down where, you know, they start throwing out names of directors and too expensive, you know, they're booked, can't get them. And eventually you start coming up with names of directors who haven't worked in a while.
Right.
And you're thinking it's almost like they're first-timers again. You're going to give them a shot, you know, to come back. And again, a good position to be in because you know that director has got something to prove and they're going to put everything they have in it.
Right.
Another note on Phil Juanu that I think is interesting is he has also been making a film for the past 20 years in the spirit of Michael Apted's Up series.
Right.
Where he took a group of 7-year-old children and interviewed them when they were 7, went back when they were 14 and interviewed them again. I think he's up to 21 on all of these kids again. Unfortunately, you can't get this available anywhere. I've looked for it and haven't been able to find it. It's been shown on television, but I don't think it's been available in home video in any way.
Right.
But I've always admired Apted series.
And so what he's pledging to do that...
He did the American version.
So he's pledging to do that, though, for the rest of these people's lives, right?
Yeah.
And he's going to keep hitting it,
Which, to me, is probably, you know, the greatest film a filmmaker can make, in my mind, because it's all real.
Right.
And you're photographing somebody's life, and that's the best special effect of all.
Right.
It's just literally seeing the clips of them when they were 7 and then when they're 48. Apted's Up series is, you know, it's unconventional, but it is quite a remarkable cinematic achievement.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing is that, you know, there are people languishing in movie jail. You know, and here's another thing about movie jail. It's really, you know, we don't know. I mean, it could be that some of these folks have purposely pulled themselves out of it. We know that, you know, when we talked about Shane Black last week, that you know, Shane pulled himself out for a while. He took a break. Mm-hmm. You know, he certainly had the money. So, you know.
And there's other directors that we can kind of go into a self-imposed director's jail.
Right.
Martin Scorsese in 1983 came out with a big flop called The King of Comedy.
Yeah, but it's great, expensive. Though.
Oh, it's one of his best.
Absolutely.
It was expensive. Nobody went and saw it. It was pulled out of theaters after 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was, you know, one of his more $25 million movie was expensive back then.
Right.
Raging Bull didn't make a lot of money either. Mm-hmm. It was well respected. De Niro won the Oscar for it, but it didn't make a whole bucket loads of cash. Mm-hmm. And we know New York, New York didn't do very well either, right, in the box office. So by that time, he had was getting ready to start Last Temptation of Christ. Paramount pulled the plug literally, mm-hmm, 2 weeks before he was getting ready to shoot. This, wow, is 1983.
Too controversial.
And Aidan Quinn would have played Jesus had that version gone forward, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
So he found himself in a position to where he had a film canceled in Hollywood. And, you know, they didn't want to make the type of films that he wanted to make. He had a choice. Do I want to make their films, or do I want to go off and do documentaries? Because, mm-hmm, Scorsese has always said that is, you know, whenever I stop making films, I'll just do documentaries, you know. But what he did do is he sat out for almost 2 years and then came back with a very small little independent film, $4.5 million, called After Hours. And he did that primarily to see if he could get back to doing 25 setups in one day instead, mm-hmm, of three. Mm-hmm. You know, the slow pace on Key and Comedy, you know, had slowed him down, and it changed, you know, everything he was about as a filmmaker. He kind of needed to get back to his roots.
Right.
And the next film, Color Money, solidified him as a commercial director.
Right.
And what I've always enjoyed about that film is it's not only a comeback movie for Eddie Felsen in the movie, it's really Martin Scorsese as well. If you run the Scorsese metaphor throughout that film, he's a lot like Eddie Felsen, the character, and where he was as a director. He had to prove to Hollywood that he could pull off Color Money, you know? They all took cuts in salary to get the movie made, and he ended up bringing it in under budget, on time, and it's a spectacularly visually impressive movie.
Well, see, what's so amazing about that is someone with a name like Scorsese has to prove something to Hollywood, and that's obviously the case. You know what I mean? Is that, mm-hmm, you know, but I mean, that's just insane. I mean, if that's Scorsese, what about the regular guys? What about, you know, Paul W.S. Anderson? You know what I mean? Little guy. You know what
well,
I mean? Who made
the nice
his bomb.
Thing about Anderson, and didn't he said that, I think, sometime after Soldier.
Well, here, I got a quote for you. Let me read you this, okay?
Okay.
Okay, this is what P.T., not P.T., sorry.
P.W.S.
P.W.S. said. He said, I would say the biggest trial of my career professionally is I released a movie called Soldier, starring Kurt Russell, which was just a disaster. I mean, the movie tanked at the box office, and the result of that in Hollywood is that you're a kind of only good as your last film. And my last film was a disaster. So at that point, I kind of found myself in director's jail. So no one wanted to work with me, and I had to kind of work my way out of that. And that took a couple of years. I mean, a lot of directors who have a big failure in Hollywood don't work at all. I mean, I have friends who are directors who had similar experiences, and they haven't directed movies in 5 or 6 years. So, you know, it's showing you that, you know, with someone like Scorsese, that was self-imposed. But with, you know, regular guys like Anderson, you know, who had a chance to make a movie, they're going to be thrown in director jail, and they've got to work their way out of that. And I think that's a real common thing, too, is there's really two methods to escape movie jail. And one of them is to work, go backwards, you know, do some TV projects, do some smaller films, and that's what Anderson did. He worked on some TV stuff. Kind of show that you're able to do that, and, you know, not just give up the ghost and leave. Because I think that's the worst thing that you can do, is just disappear. He was able to get his way back up to, you know, becoming a pretty stable action director today, who, you know, we only like because he just barely made Aliens versus Predator decent. But before then,
he's a solid B movie director.
Yes,
for
is.
Sure. And you know, it comes down to choices. It's what do you want to do? What are you willing to lower yourself to? Scorsese, right, could have worked if he wanted to do Martin Scorsese's Flashdance, or Martin Scorsese's Beverly Hills Cop, or Martin Scorsese's Witness.
Yeah.
All three of those could have been completely different movies had he decided, I'm going to do those.
Right.
He didn't want to do that. He didn't want to make those pictures, you know, for whatever reason. I mean, he says that he didn't know how to do it, you know, or he didn't know what he could bring to it. Another director that I think, you know, took both paths is Steven Soderbergh. Because, you know, obviously after Sex, Lies, and Videotape, you know, he sort of infamously said, well, it's all downhill from here. But his second film, Kafka, was deliberately an art movie.
Right.
I mean, it was shot mostly in black and white, you know, it was not a commercial vehicle in any way. But it's well-crafted. It's a respectable film.
Right.
His third film was actually, I think, is one of the best films he's made, but nobody's seen it. It's called King of the Hill.
Yeah,
not the cartoon series.
Yes. Hey, what are you talking about, man?
But it's it was based on a novel, and he adapted the novel himself. And it's got a young Adrian Brody in it, and Jesse Bradford, and it's a remarkable film, full of emotion. And his work as a director is stellar in it. But the movie died, did no box office at all, and. The film that he chose to do after that, The Underneath, didn't do any box office either, and it actually frustrated him with the process of making movies, enough to where he did a self-imposed exile. And I actually kind of like The Underneath. I think it's a crafty little thriller. It's a great B-movie thriller, but it's got some A-level acting, certainly from Peter Gallagher in it. But he went away, went back to Louisiana, Baton Rouge, and self-financed Schizopolis. And made a film with a crew of three people, you know, putting himself in front, you know, in the main lead acting role.
Right.
Just to do something experimental, spontaneous, and get back the love of making movies that was obviously being drained from him through the process of the industry.
Right.
And I think Schizopolis is a fabulous film. There's nothing else out there like it. If you think you've seen a lot of movies, rent Schizopolis, because you've not seen that movie or anything quite like it.
Mm-hmm.
You might have to see it twice just to wrap your brain around it. But what it did is, between that and also doing the concert film of Grey's Anatomy with Spalding Gray, it sort of, you know, it was a good way to recharge his own batteries. And when Casey Silver over at Universal, who was a big fan of Soderbergh, because Universal did both King of the Hill and The Underneath, he suggested to Soderbergh this project called Out of Sight. And Soderbergh turned it down right away as almost a reflex, because he'd just been turning down most of these Hollywood-type movies. And Silver called him back and sort of convinced him that this would be a good match for his talents. It'd be a good move. You know, again, it would show everyone that, you know, he can come in and, you know, make a good craft, a commercial picture. And he turned out to make one of George Clooney's best movies.
Well,
in the process.
And that definitely opened up his relationship with George Clooney, which is still thriving today. And I might add, it was really that movie really brought Jennifer Lopez out into the limelight.
It's the best thing she's done.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's been downhill for her ever since, definitely. But that was the thing. And she was really nobody before then. She had done, like, Money Train or something. And
Selena.
Yeah, right. Selena. Okay, yeah, that was, granted, that was a big movie. But, yeah, it was showing that she could do something a little different and a little more high class than just this one biopic, you know, if she can only do the music thing. And
yeah, she was sexy and she was tough.
Definitely. And that jump-started her career big time.
And Clooney was still in the movie. His head wasn't moving all over the place. His body wasn't jerking around, you know?
He wasn't doing his
ER actually
stuff.
Could hold a frame without having to do anything.
Well, and it took him out of the ER thing. It was like, you know, are you going to be a TV guy or are you going to be a movie guy? And this is one of the things that took him over. But anyways, you know, looking at that.
Hey, important to note, though, Out of Sight didn't make a lot of money either.
Right.
You know, a lot of people say it was sort of mishandled or mismarketed, but it got great reviews.
Right.
And it basically gave Soderbergh some breathing room, because the film he came out with the next year, The Limey, sort of back to his indie roots. But, you know, he was absolutely on fire as a director in that film. The editing in The Limey, if for anyone that loved to see, you know, some type of vertical editing, it's masterful in The Limey. And after that, he came back with the 1-2 punch of Aaron Brockovich and Traffic. and found himself with two Oscar nominations.
Yeah, and he was he was gone then. I mean, he could do anything he wanted to do.
And this is from a guy that, you know, was in movie jail, practically, because, you know, they weren't, you know, looking to go run out and grab Soderbergh, because, unfortunately, all the good reviews he got for King of the Hill didn't matter. It didn't make any money, so no one cared.
Right.
It didn't win any Oscars or Golden Globes, or it didn't get any outside or inside recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's the rap sheet. That's all anyone ever cares about, is the rag of that info on it. How much did it make? How many awards, you know?
Well, look at, you know, let me flash over to this other guy. You've heard of Mark Waters before. And started off in his career with The House of Yes, Independent. I think it made like, you know, it didn't make much, but it started him off.
It was well regarded.
Yeah, and then he did this thing called Head Over Heels with Freddie Prinze Jr. that in 2001, which really tanked at the box office, okay? You know, so he had started with this, you know, really hot career, because I think that there was some good word of mouth from House of Yes. You know, here's a good indie filmmaker. Let's give him a shot. He did this movie with Freddie Prinze Jr. And, you know, and he had said that ahead of time that Freddie Prinze Jr. Had just made like three sucky movies. And then here comes his movie. And so it's just like everyone's sick of the guy at this point and doesn't want to see it. And, you know, that has a lot to do with it, too. I think, you know, rewinding a little bit back to Geely, is that I think that with Geely, people were sick to death of seeing Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck and all their crap that was out in the tabloids and everything. And so everyone was just, you know, waiting to dig their knives into that film. So,
people relished in it. They loved the fact it was getting such bad notice.
Sure.
I mean, Hollywood is a town that thrives on other people's failures, not other people's success.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you quoted Shane beautifully in the last episode that talked about that. But that's an important factor that you have to keep in mind, is everyone in Hollywood wants to make sure everyone else is down because it gives them the impression that there's an opening for them to be up.
Right.
And I just think that's a sad way to have an industry run.
Well, it's terrible, and we definitely saw that in Geely. But coming back to Mark Waters, anyways, he did Head Over Heels, and I got a little quote from him here. And he said that you know, he had had some other things in the works, you know, some scripts that were about ready to go. He was going to direct and whatnot. And the studio said to him after this, they said, we love the script, and we're going to pay you your option. But we can't get anyone involved with the project if we hire you as director. So we have to say goodbye. Okay, if that's not Director J, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then after that, I was getting dumped left and right. I had to start from scratch. I was actually worse off than if I'd never made a movie at all.
Well, he can say that, but he got paid for not making a movie.
Yeah.
So I don't have a lot of sympathy for that.
Yeah.
You know, take that money and go out and make your own movie. You know, shoot a short little independent film for $20,000 because you just pocketed $100,000, you know, for not making a film. But, it would be, 2 years before Freaky Friday would come out.
Well, and the nice thing, the smart thing is that he was in movie director jail. In the article that I had found, he said, I was in movie jail here. But, you know, he didn't wait too long, because next year he had a TV movie that came out called Warning Parental Advisory, okay, which I guess, I don't know, somehow impressed the folks at Disney, because then in 2003 he did a little film called Freaky Friday,
mm-hmm.
which we know, you know, was a huge hit for Disney. It really catapulted Lindsay Lohan into that, you know, lead teen actress role. It was a great comeback role for Jamie Lee Curtis. It was a fun little movie. It was a family movie. It made a lot of money. They spent $26 million on it, and they got $110 back, you know, theatrically.
See, that's a hit.
So that's definitely a hit. So you know, at that point, Waters was out of director jail. And then he got to go on and do Mean Girls in 2004, which was another hit, you know, another Lindsay Lohan thing. They spent $17 on it, made $86. It's almost $100 million. That's a huge success, too. And so, you know, it goes to show you that, you know, he obviously had the chops in him to be a money-making machine for somebody, okay? He was in that director jail. He worked his way out, and I think really just Disney gave him that shot to be able to break out of it. Now, he just recently did that. Remember that one that came out, Just Like Heaven, with Reese Witherspoon?
Right.
Okay. And it came and went. So, I mean, I don't know how that's going to affect his career.
Considering Reese's previous numbers, it's going to be considered a disappointment.
Yeah.
But when Sweet Home Alabama got knocked over the fence, what, 40-something million opening weekend?
Yeah.
It set her in a new stratosphere, mm-hmm. you know? Because then she came out with the Legally Blonde 2. And, well, it's just not a good movie,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
I like Legally Blonde. I'll go on record. I've seen it at least twice.
Ooh.
Once on DVD and once on cable.
I'm sending you to Podcaster's Jail for seeing that, man.
But it's entertaining. Guilty pleasure, whatever. It made me laugh.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen a lot worse of that type of movie to where you do the vehicle with the actress and, you know, it's better than some of Goldie's, you know, lesser efforts.
Yeah, yeah.
But now, you know, she's expected, they want to see that $40 million opening
right.
on all Reese movies,
right.
you know, and it's just.
They want her to be the next Julia Roberts. And so, but, you know, yeah, that movie, I have it here that it cost $58 million and it made $48 million. So that's definitely, you know, down from what they expected from her and, you know, probably him as well, since he had made two pretty much big hits in a row. But he's still not in director jail. Because he's going to be doing this Secret Life of Walter Mitty remake.
Oh, he's doing that. Okay.
Yeah, he's
that's been bouncing around.
Yeah,
for
that's
a while.
Bouncing around, and apparently that's supposed to happen next year, and we'll see. But you know, I don't know that I really don't know his status as of now. But I think it's really cool that he was able to break out of it.
Well, and I think also you probably got to give a lot of credit to the agents that handle these directors.
Oh, absolutely.
Because a good agent has already lined up the director's next film before the flop comes out.
And you gave me this quote. I want to read. This is a great quote you sent me. And this is an agent talking about it. And he says, how do they deal with stalled careers, which would mean, you know, director jail? And the quote in this article says, a really good agent will work twice as hard for someone who is in so-called movie jail, having had a few bombs. What an agent does is set up meetings with studios and coach the talent on how to position himself. The usual strategy seems to be either the Vince Vaughn rehabilitation, he's going to be funny, swingers guy from now on and no more serial killers, or the Rennie Harlan repositioning. Yes, he was arrogant, but he's newly humble and motivated. So, you know, definitely, man. Agent, huge in all this. Huge.
Well, and Rennie Harlan, too. Jeez. I tell you what, that guy has been living off of the credit of Die Hard 2 and Cliffhanger for far too long.
Man.
Now, I know people like Cutthroat Island, and no, I do not think it's a catastrophe. You know,
right.
It's a well-produced movie. I don't say it's well-directed. It's well-produced. It's lavish. It's lush. It looks big, you know. And,
well, and you know, I got
and some, all that. But
you know, I got some.
It's not great.
I got some stats here. And Rennie Harlan hasn't made a theatrical profit since 1993.
That's since Cliffhanger, right?
That's since Cliffhanger.
And let's face it, that movie shouldn't have even been a hit.
Exactly. It's crap.
I mean, we just been so hungry for any kind of action.
Exactly.
At that time. It came out before Jurassic Park, though, didn't it? Like a few weeks earlier.
I'm not sure. It says 93, Cliffhanger.
Yeah, it was pre-summer.
But it really wasn't that big of a hit theatrically. It was they spent 65 on it, and they made 84. It was really, it had a new life on video afterwards.
It must have done really well overseas.
Yeah, but if you...
That's the number we're not considering.
But if you look at Rennie, and you say, you know, and this is another big question, is it, you know, who should be in movie jail and who isn't? Because, you know, when you see, and I'm not even talking, you know, just is the movie good or is the movie bad? I'm just talking finance right now for a second, which is what we all agree Hollywood looks at. But if you look at Cutthroat Island, it cost $92 million and it made $10. I mean, that is a colossal catastrophe.
And people complain about Heaven's Gate?
Yeah, exactly. It should be Cutthroat Island. The next year, he got to do Long Kiss Goodnight, which we talked about last week. And it cost $65 million and it made $33 million.
Nice.
Another catastrophe. Okay, you know, he had to wait 3 years, but he finally got to make Deep Blue Sea. That was, you know, it wasn't so bad, but it cost $78 million, made $73 million, had a little life in video, I guess.
It did well overseas.
Right,
too.
And I don't think people necessarily look at that as such a bomb, but it, you know, it broke even, basically. But hello, in 2001 we have Driven.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
the re-team with Stallone.
The re-team with Stallone that, you know, it was like, ooh, they're back together again. But, you know, Driven cost $72, made $32.
$72 they spent on Driven?
Well, sure. How much do you think they paid Stallone to do it, you know?
Yeah, but anyways, Driven needs to be made for about $25 or $30 million.
Exactly.
That's about all you can think about spending on a movie like that if you want it to be profitable.
But you're seeing at this point Rennie kind of scaling back and starting to do some smaller things. He did this Mindhunters that was a tank also. You know,
heck, it sat on a shelf for a year. You know, longer.
It cost $27 million and it only made $4.5 million.
Well, they barely released it.
Yeah.
You know, it was headed straight for video and they gave it a nod. You know, release.
Yeah.
And The Exorcist actually was that was after Mindhunters. He shot it after, didn't he?
Yeah. And this, the part two of The Exorcist prequel, you know, the second take on it, you know, because they didn't like Paul Schrader.
The B Team prequel.
The B Team, yeah. You know, it cost $50 million and it only made $41 million back. So, you know, what cracks me up is that what the hell were the, was the studio thinking? They had spent $30 million on Schrader's version, didn't release it, and then said, "Oh, let's spend more. Let's spend $50 million on Rennie's version because we want, you know, a jump out and scare you movie." And you know, they lost money. The whole thing was a giant catastrophe because they just lost money and lost money. Now I don't know if people are interested in going and doing the video thing like you've done before, where you compare the two, but. Man, just a complete, you know, I just can't figure why they looked at those stats and said, Rennie's our man, you know?
Well, I'm sure it was just he was willing to come in and do it, you know?
Right.
I'm sure it was very difficult to find someone that wanted to come into that situation because talk was all over town anyway, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But the new humble Rennie Harlan, sure, he'll come in and do it. You know, he wants to, hopefully, he's thinking that this might be a good commercial property that will spring him back.
Well, but
you got to remember, though, there's a reason why they wanted to make this Exorcist prequel.
Mm-hmm.
When you re-release The Exorcist to theaters in, what, 2000 they did? And it could make another $50 to $60
million? Yeah.
There's money in that Exorcist coffin, you know. there's money. I think a modestly budgeted prequel between the $20 and $30 million range is not a bad investment, because there's if it did 41 with Harlan's version, if it had cost 20, it'd have been a mid range hit.
Yeah,
and I know it had done fine, you know, overseas and on video there to justify, you know, that. But to spend $50 million on it, that's, you know. I just think you have unrealistic expectations on what the final result can be.
Yeah, and so
financially,
you know,
wise,
and I guess it's just shocking to me. You know what I mean? What has he done? You know, and I love Die Hard 2, and it was a big hit. You know, and it kept that series going. But really, that's the only movie of his that I give a flying rip about.
Well, I think, you know, Rennie is like a checklisted director of what. I think certain people think they need to make a hit movie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Rennie's a good shooter.
Sure.
He knows how to shoot good coverage and he can edit together certain scenes and you know, he can plow through a production. He knows the inner workings of how to get a movie made, you know, to where at least there's something up on screen that doesn't look cheap.
Right.
You know, that you know, looks how a movie's supposed to look and he can do that, you know. And you would think, oh, well, anybody should be able to do that. Well, that's not always the case.
Yeah.
Not everyone can, you know.
Well, he's proven that he can make a movie, absolutely. You know, all you have to do is look at Nightmare on Elm Street, Die Hard, Cliffhanger. I mean, he can make a movie from A to Z and not make it a catastrophe. A lot of his movies aren't a catastrophe. They're just there. They just
lie
on the page.
And he can add a little visual interest to his work.
Well, sure.
You know?
Sure, he can ramp up his frames
per
second.
But what he's not good is pacing, tone, and dealing with actors. That's
right.
Not his strength.
Right.
And often those movies, or often the movies in those particular areas, the seams are showing.
Well, here, this begs a question, okay? And because when you, like I said, when you look at Rennie and you see, and I mean, really, Rennie really is a McMovie director. I mean, just an older age McMovie director who's been around for a while.
And I think
not in the new mold.
He would admit to it as well.
Right. He's not necessarily into the new mold of Ratner, but at least he's kind of the granddaddy of the McMovie directors that are out there now. But it really begs a question, is should Movie Jail exist? I mean, is it a good thing?
Hmm.
You know?
Well, you know, if if you want to rotate and you took a chance on someone and it didn't work out, it does seem fair. It's like, well, unfair that, okay, kid, you had your shot. You're done now, you know, because it takes time to nurture talent. You know, sometimes it's not always going to come through on the first film, you know, right away.
Right.
And then, you know, it'll bloom on later films. You know, it's tougher in today's industry to where, you know, a typical director might make 10 films in their life, you know, or one every couple of years. I mean, it's just the process has changed a lot from in the studio system to where a director might do 5 films a year, you know. And I think that's why those guys were so good, is they were churning them out all the time. It's like being a theater director and having 20 plays under your belt, you know. Your 21st through 30th play are going to have all that experience behind it, you know, that you're going to be bringing to the production.
Yeah.
And a lot of these directors, before they shoot their first movie, don't have a lot of experience. They might have done a little short film or a video or a commercial, but that's all they're bringing to the table, you know. Some of them have gone off and done, you know, independent films and then stepped up to Hollywood movies, and the transition's been seamless, you know.
Well, obviously everyone learns from making more. I mean, even regular folks, if you just keep doing it, you get better and better at your craft because you learn from example. You learn from, you know, I learned not to do this, and I learned that this is
good. Is it fair
to
throw them in jail because the movie didn't make money?
Right.
I'm
well,
not sure.
We'll see that, and that's the big question in Hollywood, you know. I think, whereas it may not be fair to one person who we know has a track record, like Martin Brest, although he does deserve a good spank on the ass for Geely. You know what I mean? But, you know, I'd take Martin Brest over Rennie Harlan any day.
Well, sure. I would, too.
You know, and that's the question. But Rennie's working. And, you know, and he's got 3 more
but
movies
you know
lined
what?
Up.
I bet if Martin Brest wanted to do something like Exorcist Beginning, he might be able to get that gig.
Yeah, maybe,
I don't know.
Maybe.
It's hard to get into his mind to know the kind of movie that he'd be willing to make.
Right.
You know? And let's face it, you know, once a director realizes he's in director's jail or that industry perceives him as that, he's going to do anything to climb out, you know. A lot of them will. They're going to take anything they can get just to prove that, you know, they're capable and willing and can play along and can deliver.
You know, there's a lot of names that, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that could be in conceived movie director jail. You know, do you remember a dude named John Patrick Shanley?
Oh, yeah. He did Joe vs. Volcano.
Joe vs. the Volcano. I enjoyed that movie. Okay,
well,
and
he
also
a playwright, too.
Well, but
a very successful playwright.
Well, he won an Oscar for Moonstruck.
Right.
Okay, and his career was going through the roof as far as, you know, film goes. And maybe he's doing it on Broadway. I really don't know.
He has been. He's had a lot of plays you know, on Broadway that he's written and directed.
So then he's just gone over to that route and stayed away from films, I'm guessing.
Well, you know, what I've looked at is he wrote a great screenplay for Moonstruck. He had this really odd little fable. He wrote and directed it, and that was it. Who's to say he has to have a career as a director?
No, he doesn't.
You know, he went out and he made his little movie, and that was fine. And a lot of people like it.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that enough? You know, does he have to go and direct, you know, the latest sequel to something or the latest remake?
Well, and see, that's the question. Is it a self-imposed? And it could just be that he's not interested. That, you know, all the crap that he went through over Joe versus the Volcano, and from what I heard, he did go through a lot of crap about that, is that he may have just said, to hell with this. I don't want this. I mean, certainly he's not. You're not tied to the rack of being a director.
Right. But, you know, I get the feeling that, you know, certainly a lot of directors face something that some actors do, is they face an age barrier. To where they're just considered like old and, you know, not hip and not current.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of a director, and this name will probably throw some people out there for a loop, but Richard Rush.
Mm.
Who, you say? Well, he directed one of the best films about filmmaking ever made called The Stuntman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a phenomenal film. And it's quirky and it's surreal. And
what year did that come out?
79?
79.
I think.
Okay.
It's got an amazing Peter O'Toole performance on it. It's a great movie that sort of looks behind the scenes at how movies are made. But it works on many metaphorical levels. And it's directed about as well as you could ever hope to direct that particular material.
Mm-hmm.
It's fabulously directed.
Yeah.
But hell, he didn't work again until 1994.
Wow.
Now, was this because all the projects he wanted to do, nobody else wanted to finance, or just nobody wanted to direct him, mm-hmm. or didn't want anything to do with him? But it wouldn't be until the Bruce Willis vehicle Color of Night that he would return as a director and writer. So maybe it was a self-imposed, you know, right. I want to write and direct, and that's it. But he hasn't made a film since then, and I don't know if he will again, mm-hmm. you know. And it's, you know, he's had a distinguished career in Hollywood from the 60s, but let's face it, a lot of the John Schlesingers and some of the older directors are not necessarily going to get the call today. You know, the Zack Snyders of the world are going to get that
mm-hmm.
call.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's interesting because, I mean, there's so many other guys. Yeah, there's so many other names we could throw in the hat. You know what I mean? We had talked about Rob Reiner. Is he in Director Jail? I mean, I don't know. He was such a hit machine. You know what I mean? And then he's made just all these just, you know, kind of lame movies as of late.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? He's got a new one coming out pretty soon here. Rumor has it. But, you know, we saw him go from just a massive, you know, hit machine in the 80s and early 90s to what he's doing now.
And he was in a position to generate his own projects.
Yeah.
So he's not kind of like the typical director for hire. He had Castle Rock and he was, you know, developing right. his own material. But, you know, and there's another case of a self-imposed movie jail by just giving the finger to everyone in Hollywood. I think of Tony Kaye in the experience of American History X.
Mm.
To where, you know, he was a very successful British commercial director.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, had won every major award and was the highest paid and everything. And he held off making his first feature film for a long time because he really wanted to do something special. I mean, this is a guy who obviously thinks he's as good, or I don't know if I should say as good, but thinks he's thinks along the lines of a Kubrick or Orson Welles,
uh-huh,
okay?
Uh-huh.
Thinking along the lines of doesn't necessarily mean you think you're as good.
That you are, yeah.
But you're trying to read their book mm-hmm. and follow it, mm-hmm. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But he did American History X, and he made a gritty and powerful film out of it.
Yeah.
But we don't know the version that he liked because he cut the movie and then decided, you know, he showed it to people. They got a really good response. He says, no, I'm not happy with it. I want to recut it. And then he took out like 25 minutes of the movie, which really pissed off Edward Norton because he was just cutting out a lot of the good stuff that he liked.
Yeah.
And then he kept tinkering with the film, and then he said that he had a completely new vision of how he wanted to do it, and he wanted to go off and shoot new scenes. He plugged $1 million of his own money into the movie. And finally, New Line just got sick of him, and they took the film away from him
mm-hmm.
and said, look, we're taking it away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they brought in Norton. Norton worked on another cut, and that was the cut that eventually got released. But Tony Kaye started a campaign against New Line Cinema. You know, first he tried to sue him for some ridiculous $100 million figure or something. And then he started going to meetings bringing a rabbi with him and videotaping everything, you know, which was really making people uneasy and nervous and, you know, strange combative material. Tony Kaye was spending $30,000 for full-page ads in Variety that were nothing but a black page with a quote in white,
mm-hmm.
you know. It was really strange way to send a message to New Line Cinema. And he didn't buy one of those pages. He bought at least 10.
Wow,
you know?
Wow.
It was a very interesting insider thing going on at the time.
Well, he deserves director jail then.
And yeah, and it, like I said, self-imposed in many ways, yeah. and he hasn't made another film since.
Yeah, well, who wants to work with
him? Is he talented?
That?
He's enormously talented.
Right.
Would I be interested in seeing his next film? Absolutely, I would be. More so than any of the McMooks out there directing today.
McMooks. I know who you're talking about. Well, but you know what? Take this. If you're a producer, if you're with a studio, and you're lining up your director for a film that you've set out to do, and you know there's some money riding on it, are you going to hire Tony Kaye? Are you going to hire Brett
Ratner? If it's a $5 million film, I will hire Tony Kaye because he'll make it look like a $20 million film.
Right.
If it's a $25 million film, I don't know.
Right.
You know?
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. Are you going to hire Tony Kaye? Are you going to hire Brett Ratner?
Well,
you know what I mean? And that's what they do. They say, oh, I don't want all those problems. I don't want all that psychosis. What if we want to take it away from him because he's a nut? You know, mm-hmm. we have a product here. We've got our money tied up in this. And they say, hey, give me Brett. Brett's nice. Mm-hmm. Brett's funny. He's easy. He gets along with everybody. No problem.
He will never have a problem working with that attitude in Hollywood, unless he makes five bombs in a row. You know? And right now, he's not setting himself up for any bombs, because X-Men 3 is going to make a lot of money.
Right.
Regardless of how it's perceived in the other two factors, critical or audience, it'll squeak out like Fantastic Four.
It'll get a kick-ass first weekend, absolutely.
Yeah, it'll
just
be huge.
Because of what it is.
And we know his next movie, Rush Hour 3, mm-hmm. will be huge. So I don't know when he's going to do his next Family Man, but it's going to take a couple of big colossal failures to slow down the Brett Ratner
show. Well, you know what's sad about Brett Ratner is that we probably talk about him every week. So, you know, he's on everyone's tongue. And so, you know, maybe that's exactly what he wants.
Well, in my opinion, and maybe this is just mine, but in many ways, Brett Ratner should be inspiration to filmmakers out there everywhere. Mm-hmm. Not because they like his work, or they like what he does, or even thinks that he's good. Mm-hmm. But it just goes to show you that if Brett Ratner can make it in that industry as far as he can and has, really anything's possible.
Yeah.
You know, it's more about knowing how to play the game than having the talent of a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
But once you learn how to play the game, the talent will come in handy.
Well, see, you know, that's one thing, is that when you are trying to be a filmmaker in Hollywood, you can't just be talented. You got to know how to play the game, too. You got to have both. And if you lack one, you're going to die. You know what I mean? Even if you have all the talent in the world, if you lack one, you're going to have a real tough time.
And it really is a lot of times who you know. I mean, deals are made at parties. You know, deals are made, you know, over lunch and over dinner.
Sure.
There's a process of, okay, I've seen your demo reel. Oh, I know you're good.
Right.
But can I work with you?
Right. And then once you get to talk to somebody, it's like, hey, absolutely.
You know, hey, what's your vision for the movie? God, this guy sold me on his pitch, mm-hmm. you know, over dinner. I hired him that night,
right.
you know.
Right.
Never made a movie in his life, but, you know, he convinced me he could do it. Uh-huh. You know, that happens all the time. I mean, let's face it, we have more first-time directors doing major motion pictures than ever before in movie history.
Hey, and if they're slick and they know what and they can talk their way in, hey, I mean, if that's the game to get you in, then, hey, good job for being such a great talker. You know, but, hey, looking at Director Jael and Hull here, you know, we know it exists out there. It's an unspoken rule. Okay, it exists. We've talked.
It's even hard to find information on.
It is.
I know we both did searches for this episode,
right.
And we were quite surprised at how much we did not find.
Well, and I think,
about movie Jael.
And that's what I think. I think it's an understood thing. It's just putting a name on, you know, someone who's just made a film that the industry is not interested in. You know, or it's just got a stink to it, and they don't want to work with them for a while. You know, and I think that it's that attitude where you're only as good as your last picture. You know, that quote, and you know, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I don't know, but you know, it does exist. It is out there. We've looked at a few names, but there's many more people that we've missed or that are worthy of discussion. But it's there.
Well, it goes to true. There are directors making bad films that get to keep working, and there's directors that made a good film that made no money that can't work.
Right.
You know?
Absolutely.
And there's really only one solution, or there's a few variations, but you got to make movies for less money so you can make them more profitable,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or don't take on these big behemoth projects that, you know, are going to end up biting you in the butt. I mean, has McGee worked since Charlie's Angels 2?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I guess he could. I mean, they were considering him for Superman, and I don't know if Charlie's Angels 2 was considered to be a flop by any means.
Well,
but
it was terrible.
I don't know how well received it was, and
terrible.
I don't know how much money it made. I know they spent a lot of money on it, though, more than they ever should have.
Yeah.
But everyone's chasing those blockbuster dollars, you know, and these directors, I think Director's Jail might be a good cooling off period.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
To almost reorganize and rethink, you know, what type of filmmaker do I want to be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what should I be doing? And I think now that we're moving into this new digital age, Director's Jail is going to have a different outlook from here on out.
Sure.
Because while the industry might put you in jail, you can certainly today get out there and make your own project. And you don't need a lot of big financing to do it.
Hey, and
let's face it, once everyone starts shooting on HD, we're going to get a flood of all kinds of new, you know, multimedia.
Well, I mean, that could be the best thing for people. I mean, if Hollywood turned their back on you, and then you're determined, and you go out there and make your movie in HD, and it's a masterpiece, well, then what would you want to do? Go back and take it back? You know, and you'd rather do, you know, the Hollywood movie they can plug you into a you know, a typical script to? No. You know, I mean, sometimes it's probably better, you know. And I bet you, you know, some of these directors would tell you, hey, best thing that ever happened to me.
It is. I think that is a formula right there to do good work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is to have it be rejected by everyone else, but you still believe in it, and you know how good it's going to be.
Right.
And you carry it on anyway.
You know, we could, like, go to jail for this.
Mm-hmm. All right, look, let's have some fun real quick before we shut this episode down. Okay, you want to send somebody in jail. You're a studio. Who are you going to send in jail? You get one free pick. Go directly to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Who are you sending?
If I'm a studio?
Yeah. Oh, well, okay, no, let me rephrase. Because we're having...
You're going to have to.
Because we're having fun.
I'm looking at the spreadsheet at the studio, you know?
Okay, forget it, forget it.
I'm going to send all these arty-farty f***s that can't make any money to jail.
Yeah. Okay, we don't want that. We want good movies, okay? We want to send the McMovie guys to jail. All right.
The McMooks?
All right, you get to send one guy to jail. Who are you sending? Not studios.
Who do I get to take out of jail?
No, let's send someone to jail first.
Is this a prisoner swap?
Exactly. You get to swap. You get to put one in and take one out.
Well, you go ahead and start. I got to think on it.
All right. Well, I'm going to send in Rennie.
You're going to send in Rennie.
I'm sick of Rennie.
He's done.
Rennie's done. I want Rennie
you
gone.
You haven't seen a Rennie film since Long Kiss Goodnight.
No, I saw Deep Blue Sea. Deep Blue Sea was the last Rennie I saw.
Oh, you did see that. Okay.
No. I'm sending Rennie in. I don't want to see his name anymore. I'm tired of him. And he doesn't produce, you know, and he keeps making these middle-of-the-road things. So Rennie goes in, and when I'm in there, I got to look at my massive list of directors. I'm going to pull out Kevin Reynolds.
Hey, I couldn't think of a better name.
Okay,
than that.
I love
choice.
I love Kevin Reynolds, and
I do too. That guy.
Yeah.
And we almost need to talk about him in Director's Jail because Waterworld. Hello.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's huge. I mean, he came off and did that little art movie Rapa Nui after that.
Yeah.
That nobody saw. Mm-hmm. And you would think, God, why is anyone, you know, going to let him do another movie? Mm-hmm. But he went back and did a very interesting, arty little film called 187 with Samuel Jackson.
Yeah.
And then came back, I thought, with a very entertaining film, The Count of Monte Cristo. So I don't know why you wouldn't want to hire someone like Kevin Reynolds.
It may not be that Kevin Reynolds is in jail right now, because Count of Monte Cristo, I don't know that it made a lot of money, but I think it was... I've heard a lot of people say a lot of good things about it. I haven't actually seen it yet. But I want to.
It's very well directed.
Right. And so, I don't know.
It's not flashy.
Me personally,
it's just well directed.
Me personally, and mainly because, you know, Fandango was one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm sitting in Rennie, and I'm pulling out Kevin. What about you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you said it earlier, and I could just echo what you said. I'd trade a Brett Ratner for a Martin Brest.
it's Geely, by the way.
All right.
You know, it's... Because, I mean, I know Martin Brest can do exactly what Brett Ratner does anyway, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm hoping that, you know, by mingling a little bit further, he can make the material that much better.
Yeah.
You know, obviously he brought something out of Eddie Murphy that other directors haven't been able to tap into.
Yeah.
And certainly Midnight Run shows, you know, that ability as well.
Midnight Run is like, it's like I could look and just say, okay, oh, he did Midnight Run? Yeah, bring him out. You know what I mean?
You know, and I think if Martin Brest has another action comedy script, I don't think he'll have too much trouble, you know, hopefully,
but
getting it through. But maybe he needs to go do Beverly Hills Cop 4, you know, for that get-out-of-jail-free card or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, industry perception would be is yes, you need to come back and do a big hit and a big splash to put you back on the map.
Yeah. But, you know, when you're pulling him out, you pull him aside and you point your finger in your face. All right, look, Martin, don't ever do that again. No more J-Lo for you, bad boy.
Gobble, gobble.
Well, the best thing he can do is just not write a script.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he had great screenwriters before working material, and, you know, he put himself out there, you know. He wrote it, produced it, and directed it. So. Yeah.
Well, great.
But I suggest, you know, he hire Bo Goldman again, that who wrote Meet Joe Black and who wrote Sin of a Woman, and come up with something new, you know. There's got to be a lot of good scripts out there that he could attach himself to, if they even want him.
Right.
And that's the whole question of Movie Jail. Would you rather have an untalented director that's going to give you a middle-of-the-road product that'll be profitable, or take the risk on a talented director who's going to give you a spectacular movie that might be profitable?
Bull. Cow.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and wrap up episode 13, Lockdown. Hope you guys liked it. We're going to start a new thing here on the podcast page, and that'll be for whatever the current podcast page is. We're going to start adding links and articles and videos and whatever we can, whatever kind of research material we find on the web, we're going to start linking to it on the actual podcast page. So for whatever the current show is, you just go www.hollywoodsaloon.com/podcast.html and you go there. And like, for instance, on this specific episode, we're going to have this great article, Escape from Movie Jail by Richard Shepard. And that kind of started us off on this path of doing this show. So, you know, just more information if you want to dig deeper into the subject. We're going to try to put those on every episode from now on. We did it with Shane Black in the last episode, and we're going to go ahead and just keep that up. And hopefully, like I said, if it's something you want to dig into more, learn more about, get more into, you'll have the information there. And on this particular episode, I do want to give a special thanks to Randy, Marty DMC12 from the forums, and Jake. He goes by Warhorse Films on the forums. And they helped me do a little brainstorming, give us some ideas and that kind of stuff for certain directors to use. And so thank you guys for doing that. But as usual, I want to go ahead and talk about our Frapper map. We've got up to about 40 folks on there now, and that's very cool. I really enjoy that map, and it's great because it's just showing where everybody is across the world that's listening to the Hollywood Saloon. And like I said, if you join our Frapper map, and it's on our webpage, you can see it right on the front page at the bottom, or you can see off to the side there'll be links, and it'll say map there. You click on there, you can go there, and you go to the join now or add yourself or whatever it is, and you can join the map. And like I said, if you join our map, I will give you a shout-out on the show because I know that's fun for people, and it's my way of saying thanks for joining up and being a part of the saloon. So, hey, going ahead, I want to give a big shout-out to Chris Bradfields, and he is all the way over in Seoul, South Korea. So that's very cool. He says he listens to us on his morning commute, so thanks for listening, man. It's very cool, and that knowing that you're listening to us way over there is, wow, it just kind of blows my mind, but thanks for doing that. Definitely 4th of 5 over in Melbourne, Australia. Is it Melbourne or is it Melbourne? I'm guessing it's Melbourne is what I've heard before. But anyways, another Australian. Man, you guys are great. You love the saloon, and we love you guys for it. So, but 4th of 5 is one of our most active members on the forum. It's been great having him on there because you know when you go to someone's forum and you look and there hasn't been anything new, well, odds are there's something new every time because he's been posting like crazy. So thanks for being so active in the forums, man. We really enjoy you being there. Philip from Fredericksburg, Virginia, left us something on our map. So thanks, Philip, for listening. Jenny from New York, and first person from New York. Thank you big time. We like that. Mick McArt from Saginaw, Michigan. And he has a sci-fi comedy podcast called Captain Jolt. And you can get there by going to www.captainjolt.com. Now, I went over and looked at it. I haven't listened to the show yet, but it looks pretty funny. It's got crazy puppets, and it's like pop culture, and it looks like a lot of fun. I'm definitely going to give it a try, so you go too. And thanks, Mick, for hanging out at the saloon. Definitely Brock in New York is signed up on the map, and he's got a great picture of Butch and Sundance in there. So thanks for signing up, Brock. We got two folks from New York really quick, so we like that. Okay, I don't know if it's Lee or Li, but L-I-H from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Wow, another Canadian again. Canada and Australia seems to be our outside home for the saloon, so we really love that. And he or she said they love the Star Wars episode and that they're going to tell everybody about the saloon. So yes, everybody's welcome. Tell as many people as you can. We love it. So thanks for listening. Another Canadian. Okay, and last up on our list that's joined recently is John Hargrove. Now, I just want to say aloha to John because he's all the way over in Hawaii. And he's an old friend of mine and John both. And, I mean, he went to college with us, and he was in the acting class while John and I were in the film class. And he starred in a lot of John's old high school Super 8 films. So he's been with John and I for ages. And definitely, I hope he's doing great. And just hang loose over there in Hawaii, John, and take care of yourself. It's great to hear from you. So anyways, that's our Frapper Map. And like I said, join up. We'll talk about you on the next show. We love to have more and more people. As usual, you can always go to our website, www.hollywoodsaloon.com. Give us an email at hollywoodsaloon@yahoo.com. We love hearing from you. I want to talk about our forum real quick. If you're not joining into our forum and you're an active listener to your show, you're missing out because we have a great community going there with a lot of people talking about different things. And I just want to give a big shout out and a big thanks to certain people. Definitely to Profane One, my buddy Warren, who is down here in Houston with us. And he's been with us from the very beginning. But I want to give a big thanks to him. Every Tuesday, rain or shine, he puts up a new list of everything that's getting released on DVD. And puts pictures and everything. It's awesome. And that's how I keep up with my DVDs. You know, I used to go to different websites, but now all I know is that on Tuesday, if I go to my forums, Warren's got it all laid out for me. I can comment back and say, okay, I'm interested in this, not interested in that. And that's been really great. So thanks for doing that, man. A big shout out to the lovely Annie Mae. Absolutely. My best friend in the whole world. Of course, she's my wife, too. So. But she loves the forums, and I love her for taking part in it. We're having a lot of fun there. Definitely Marty DMC12, my great buddy in Canada. What a help he's been with our site, and he's a huge poster on the site. Big shout to the J-Strom, my great buddy, who has his own podcast, www.nowhereinmulberry.com. You got to go listen to Nowhere in Mulberry. You're missing out if you don't go listen to it. It's the only show that I absolutely will not miss no matter what. And I usually am one of the first guys to download it when they put it up every week. So get over there. I want to say a big hi to Monty in Las Vegas. Vegas, baby, Vegas. And he's Profane One's brother. And a lot of fun on there too. And other people. Lister comes on and leaves a lot of posts. And also 4th of 5, like I said earlier, huge poster on our forums. And great to have him. So, you know, and I'm not just singling out people just because they post a lot, but they've really, you know, jumped into our community, taken apart. We have a lot of great film discussions, and we have a lot of fun. And you are welcome into that. Come on by the forums. Just go to our website and click on the forum link, and you're in there. And a lot of great stuff going on there. And don't just visit. Join up, register, and then you can post too. And that's it. So thank you guys for listening. Thanks for all your support. This is great. Podcasting rules. And so thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.
I have to go with the Baywatch.
I'm sorry, what?
I have to go with the Baywatch. I was going to go.
You want to watch Baywatch? Roll by my apartment. We'll turn on Baywatch.
You stupid person. You stupid person. That television, the Baywatch.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.